From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. For 30 years, David Meach has tracked and studied the wolves of North America. On today's Fresh Air, he tells us about the highlight of his life, tracking Arctic wolves and observing their den of pups. Also today, we enter the junkyard mind of animator Sally Cruikshank. She animated the Ruthless credits for the film Ruthless People and the cartoon hell sequence in Twilight Zone the movie. Her latest cartoon is now touring with an animation festival. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles the Kaleidoscope, whose mix of African and Caribbean music foreshadowed today's world music. And book critic John Leonard reviews a new collection of essays by Connor Cruz O'Brien. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. David Meach describes himself as an obsessed student of wolves. Since 1968, he's tracked and observed hundreds of wolves from the air. He maintained a captive colony for 10 years and studied their behavior, and he even raised wolves for pets. But in 1986, on an expedition in the high Arctic, hundreds of miles north of Hudson Bay, he finally scored the big one. He found a pack of wolves that let him observe them, and he discovered their den of pups. This was a triumph for Meach because it is very rare for wolves to allow humans to observe them in such close proximity. Meach returned to the Arctic den and continued his research in the summers of 1987 and 88. During part of each stay, he was accompanied by a photographer. For the remainder, he was alone. Meach has written a new book about his research called The Arctic Wolf. He is a wildlife research biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and heads two international groups dedicated to wolf research and preservation. In a 1970 book about wolves, Meach described the first time he got within 15 feet of a wolf. He wrote, "I snapped the camera, and the wolf cocked its head. Its countenance was like that of a big friendly dog. It was easy to believe I could have petted the beast. It inspired me to learn all I could about the animal that had such a calm and gentle look, yet earned its living by killing." I asked Meach if this image still motivates his research.
Yes, because it sort of identified the wolf as a bundle of contradictions. In looking so friendly and in acting so amiable to its pack mates, it gives one impression, and then when you see it killing an animal, it gives another impression. Of course, that's only an apparent contradiction because we all need to kill to eat in one sense or another, whether we do it ourselves or hire somebody else to do it. But apparently, it's a contradiction, and that really intrigued me.
Why else are you an obsessive student of wolves?
Because wolves live in social groups, and they have a very complex kind of social interaction that we still don't entirely understand, even after looking at it for about 30 years. The interactions of the adults to the other pack mates, to their pups, and to the yearlings and two-year-olds in the pack are highly complex, and as I say, until we went to Ellesmere Island, where we could actually live with a pack close up, it was very difficult to understand what these interactions were like.
I think to appreciate your accomplishments, we need to know how hard it is to have direct contact with wolves. Why has it been so hard for researchers who track wolves to actually really get close to them?
Well, wolves have been persecuted throughout their history in most of the areas of the world, and that has made them extremely secretive and shy and elusive. Therefore, all the techniques we've had in the past to study them have had to be indirect. By that, I mean you have to either be sitting in an airplane watching them 1,000 feet below, or catching them and putting radio collars on and listening to what they do on the basis of their radio signals, or if you're really lucky, sitting out on the tundra somewhere half a mile away with a spotting scope and observing them. But all the techniques we've used in the past have been very, very indirect.
My guest is wolf expert David Meach. Now, you didn't find the wolves. You say they found you. How did they find you?
Well, the first time was in April of 86, and we had landed at an airstrip by a weather station, and that's one of the outposts up in the high Arctic. And I looked around As I was entering one of the outbuildings to put away some camera gear, etc., I looked around, and coming down a ridge just about 60, 70 feet away, I suddenly noticed these wolves. I couldn't believe it because they were so close to the buildings, actually. And they stood there and wondered what we were doing, I suppose, and then continued on down the ridge out onto the ice of this big fjord. And it was then that we began starting to get our camera gear back out and taking some pictures of them.
Now, the second time you saw the wolves, you lay on your belly and whined. Why did you make that sound?
Yeah, they were out by an iceberg, and I was photographing the iceberg, and I know that they had they liked to spend time out there because I saw their tracks right up on top of the iceberg. And so I was out there looking around when I rounded the bend and spotted them. And I got down on my belly, and since they hadn't run, I thought, well, these animals are somewhat approachable. Let's see how curious they are and what they would do if I called attention to myself in some way that wouldn't necessarily give them the idea I was a human. So I lay down and kind of crawled on the ice and whined. And sure enough, they did stop and got quite curious and started back towards me, close enough so that I could get a few pictures of them.
If you wanted to make them think that you were something other than human, was there a kind of animal you were trying to approximate with your whine?
Well, the whine would be, I was trying to imitate another wolf.
Not that they would necessarily
have regarded me as such, but not knowing what I was and then perhaps hearing what sounded like another wolf, I thought it would at least arouse their curiosity, which it did.
Once you started spotting the wolves on a regular basis, you wanted to acclimate them to you so that they would be comfortable around you and allow you to get close. How do you do that?
Well, the one thing is that there are no trees up in the high Arctic. There are really no places to hide. And while we were around the wolves, say 70, 80, 90 feet from them, and they weren't running from us, the main thing you need to do is stay close to them without making them afraid. So, for example, when we did approach, and we approached on snowmobiles at times, and they didn't run away, well, then what we would do is just spend time moving back and forth around them, but not close enough so that they would be afraid of us, but not so far that they wouldn't have to contend with us either. So we just stayed at a reasonable distance and watched them very carefully until we could see that they were not really afraid of us, and then we would start moving a bit closer. And at any time, if they showed that they were shy, we'd back off. But if they remained as we approached them just a bit closer, and we would never head directly into them. That is, we would not head our snow machines directly at them, but rather we would run parallel with them very slowly, but gradually closing the distance between us and them, and working over periods of hours and hours and hours, sometimes far into the night, because as you know, at that time of year, it's 24 hours of daylight, so we could work day and night. Gradually heading closer to them, they just became acclimated to us to the point at which they wouldn't run from our machines, even when we were within just a few feet from them.
My guest is David Meach. He's an expert on wolves and has studied them in different parts of the world. His new book is called The Arctic Wolf. You found a den of pups, and you describe it as really like the high point of your life. What did the wolf den look like the first time you looked in?
Well, I didn't look into the den, actually. I had seven of them, of the adults. I didn't see any pups right away. I had seven of the adults surrounding me and quite excited. They were barking and had their mane up and all, and so I knew that I was intruding on their area, and so I didn't go up and look in then. What I did is just start walking back up the hill, because I didn't want to disturb them any further. So I didn't really see the pups until the next day when I approached the den from a different direction.
And how did they look?
Well, they were There were six pups. They were out lying on the tundra. They were beige and asleep, actually. I had crawled over a ridge and just peered over and looked at them from a distance of about 200, perhaps 300 yards. And there were these six little beige bundles, is how I described them, all sleeping on the tundra around these seven white adults.
The first time you were looking in on the den, you were lying on your stomach. And a couple of the wolves spotted you doing that. Did they make you feel like a peeping Tom?
Yeah, in a way, I really felt out of place. I was clearly on their terrain, and the other thing was that I wasn't hidden at all, so that by the time they saw me, I was sort of lying in complete view of them, and in a sense, I felt like a fool because they could see me and all, but as long as they didn't run off, I guess I was quite content, even if I was a little embarrassed about their seeing me.
Well, one of the wolves led all the pups out of the den after you were spotted, but then as you were leaving, the pups were led back in, so I guess you felt you weren't really going to be perceived as a big threat.
That's right. I was worried at first. They led the pups, perhaps an eighth, maybe even a quarter of a mile away from the den, but then brought them back to it. So I realized then that they were getting used to me, even with the pups, and that I probably wasn't upsetting them.
After the wolves got acclimated with you, you were able to follow them and watch them on a kill. You watched the wolves kill a musk ox. How did you follow them? They travel pretty far each day, far away from the den.
Yeah, wolves do travel far because they have to hunt very widely in order to find prey that they can kill. And when I say widely, they cover sometimes 1,000 square miles. We had four-wheeled all-terrain vehicles that we would use to follow them. And believe it or not, they weren't the least bit concerned about these vehicles and allowed us to travel right with them wherever they went.
Was this the first time you had watched the wolves kill their prey?
No, I had watched wolves kill prey a number of times while I was in an aircraft. I've watched them kill moose, and I've watched them kill deer, and I've watched them chase caribou. But I had never been close to them while they were doing it when I was on the ground, and that's what was the big difference here.
What did you observe that you never knew before?
Well, one of the things that I was most interested in regarding how wolves kill their prey was whether the alpha animals, those are the top ranking or the leaders, the parents, let's say, of the rest of the pack. I wanted to see just whether all the members of the pack contributed equally to the kill, or whether indeed this was, as I thought, it was the parents doing the main part of it. Now, when you're in an aircraft and you're looking down on a pack of, say, 15 wolves killing a moose and swarming all over it, you can't tell one wolf from another. But since we knew each one of the wolves that we were living with in the high Arctic, we knew each one individually and could identify it. This allowed me to actually determine which ones were doing the killing and which were most active in the whole procedure. And I thought it probably would be the alphas, but I was able to confirm this here, and that was one of the main things I was interested in watching.
I know that you really liked to watch the wolves, and wolves, I suppose, when they're just in the den, or you know, when they're not on a kill, look pretty dog-like and have a very endearing expression sometimes on their face. What was your reaction watching them pretty up close eviscerate a musk ox and then walk away dripping with blood? Did it give you a different feeling about those wolves?
Well, perhaps it would have if I had seen it 30 years ago from close up, but I've studied wolves full-time for 30 years, and that means that I'm certainly quite aware of how they earn their living, and so watching them close up was not that big a shock to me. They certainly, of course, had to do a lot of biting of the animal and tearing at it, and several wolves at a time tearing from different directions and all of that, and there was a lot of blood. But I was philosophic about it. I knew that they had half dozen pups back at the den, and they had to feed them some way, and that the only way they could do it was by killing other animals. So being philosophic and trained in objectivity as a scientist, I could just sit there and be thrilled that I had a chance to watch something that goes on all over the world, either with wolves or with raptors or other kinds of carnivores that kill for a living. It goes on all over the world day in and day out. And I just happened to be here in this case watching it. And so my main attitude was how fortunate I was.
Were you able to follow the wolves back to the den and watch them feed their pups?
Yes. In fact, what I wanted to do was to get back there before they arrived. In other words, they spent a certain amount of time feeding on the kill and caching food and feeding and all. And I wanted to get back to the den while they were doing that so that I could watch when they returned and see how they fed the pups.
How do they feed the pups?
Well, two ways. They'll bring food back in their mouths and also in their stomach. And in this case, they were, in the last case where we watched them kill a muskox, they were a 20-mile straight line distance from the pups, and they carried all of the food in their stomach. So that when they approach the pups, the pups, of course, know when the adults return that they're going to have food. So the pups, being extremely hungry, mob the adults and sort of lick at their mouths. And this tends to trigger a response in the adults to regurgitate. And then the wolves gobble up all of the partially digested food.
This sounds pretty, you know, bizarre to humans to listen to, I think. But I guess since wolves can't, you know, mash the food for their young or cook it to make it tender, it's a pretty effective way of pre-digesting it for them.
Certainly. And in fact, it's really not that different from what a dog does to feed its puppies when it's real young.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk with you more about your observations of the wolves in the Arctic. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Dr. David Meech. After 28 years of studying wolves, Meech made the discovery of a lifetime in 1986. While on an expedition in the Arctic, he found a wolf den and was able to observe the pups up close. He tells the story in his new book, The Arctic Wolf. David Meech is joining us from KSJN in St. Paul. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
David Meech is my guest, one of America's leading experts on wolves. The wolves one day started to eviscerate your tent. What did you do to try to distract them from their task?
Well, the time that I was watching them actually pull my sleeping bag out at one of the tent portholes, I happened to be at the den while they were down at my tent. But there were one or two adults and the pups left at the den. And so I didn't follow our usual procedure, which was to bark at the wolves. That's an alarm call and or a threat, and it chases them off. I couldn't do that because I was so close to the den and I didn't want to scare the ones that were at the den. So I didn't bark. Rather, I let out the highest and loudest hoot, sort of a "hoo!" Type of noise as I could to carry the quarter mile that it had to carry and still not scare the adults around the den. And it worked. They heard that. And since they clearly were kind of anxious while they were pulling my sleeping bag out, as soon as they heard that hoot, they quickly dropped the sleeping bag and all ran off for about 200 or 300 yards.
You've also learned how to howl, haven't you, to try to get some response from wolves?
Yes, howling is something we've done for many years, even in our own research, say in Minnesota, where when we want to find out if the wolves or the pups are at the den in the woods and we can't see them, we will howl from a distance of, say, a quarter of a mile away. And if we get a response, which we often do, then we know that the wolves are around the den. So, I am fairly practiced at howling like a wolf.
What does your howl sound like?
Well, it sounds like a wolf howl. It's It's fairly low-pitched as opposed to the pitch of a coyote howl, which is a lot of yips and very high-pitched. Wolf howl is a very low, mournful, moan-like, long-drawn-out sound.
You know, the sound of a wolf howling is considered to be a very eerie sound by a lot of people. And for urban people like myself who are never out in the wilderness to hear actual wolves, it's a sound associated with the legends of werewolves and with monster movies. When you were alone in the Arctic and you would hear the sound of wolves howling, did it ever give you a creepy feeling? Or are you too much the scientist and too much... too familiar with and respectful of wolves to have ever felt frightened by their sounds?
Well, it's the latter. I certainly haven't ever felt frightened of a wolf howl. It's because I view it differently. I mean, I know what it is, and I just view it really no differently than any other animal sound in terms of my attitude towards it. It's always a thrilling sound. Just simply because you know that you're fairly close to the animal when it's making that noise. But it's not anything that to me is scary, because the interpretation I put on it is a more objective one.
You've written a new book about studying this pack of wolves in the Arctic. It's called The Arctic Wolf. But you describe in the book your publicity dilemma, that when you discover this pack of wolves, part of you really wanted to let everybody know about it so that you could share the results of your studies. But on the other hand, you knew if it became public that everybody would want to send their camera crews there and do a documentary. How have you resolved that?
Well, we resolved that particular issue by doing the documentary ourselves. Because we knew somebody would want to do it, and we decided that the best people to do it was ourselves. So we signed a contract with National Geographic, who incidentally had supported us on the trip, the original trips there for the magazine. And we then signed a contract with National Geographic Television to produce a documentary on the same subject. And we felt by doing it ourselves, we'd get it out of the way and sort of preempt the field, and that would minimize the chances of someone else coming up and wanting to do the same thing.
So you're not going to make public exactly where the den is?
No, certainly not. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to, and I think anyone can understand that. It's in the high Arctic, 1,000 miles north of Alaska, and that's about as far as I'm going to go with it.
Right. Okay. You've been there every summer since 1986. Are you going to go out again next summer?
Oh, certainly. I'll probably be going up to Ellesmere every summer for the rest of my life, I imagine.
Do you ever get too old for this? If you don't mind my bringing up your age, you're 51 now. I think most people at 51 would feel perhaps a little bit too old for the kind of extreme circumstances that you're subjected to alone in the wilderness in the high Arctic.
Oh, well, no, certainly I don't feel too old for it, and I don't see why I shouldn't be able to, barring some accident or severe illness, shouldn't be able to go up there for another 20 years.
How long at a time can you stay?
Well, I have a lot of duties elsewhere, and in order to go to the high Arctic, I actually have to take either annual leave or leave of absence without pay from my own job. And so I have these other responsibilities that I have to meet, and I really should get back to civilization every few weeks. So the longest I've stayed away has been about a month. I would like to spend several months up there at a time, but I usually go up for, say, 3 weeks or so and come back for a week or two and then go back up for another 3 or 4 weeks.
Now, a lot of that time you spend alone. What if something happens to you? What if you get sick or you know, forgive me for bringing this up, but have some kind of emergency? Do you have any way of staying in touch with anybody who could get you
well,
help?
Well, if I really felt that was a severe threat, there is one way I could communicate, and that is I could have what's called an emergency locator transmitter, which they have in every aircraft. And when the plane crashes, the beacon goes on automatically, and satellites pick up the emergency signal. And I could buy one of those and take it up with me. And then if I broke my leg or something, I could pull a string on it and turn it on, and some satellite would find me and send somebody up there. But I don't really feel that threatened. And generally, I try to take another person with me each time, and I've only spent a couple of weeks absolutely alone up there. Most of the time, I would have someone else with me, and my intention for the future is to have at least one person with me all the time up there.
In your book, you say that we humans judge wolves by our own standards. If they kill, they're bad. If they mate for life, that makes them better. If they kill and eat one of their own, then they're ghastly. When you're studying animals, do you try to not apply moral standards to their behavior?
Oh, certainly. I learned, 30 years ago not to do that. So that just goes without saying for any biologist, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Are the wolves endangered now?
Well, they're endangered in certain parts of the world. They're classified as endangered on the Federal Endangered Species List, for example, in Wisconsin. They're considered on the endangered species list in another category called threatened in Minnesota. They're endangered in one or two other places in the 48 states where they exist, and that's Montana, Idaho, and there's some wolves down in North Carolina that have just been reintroduced in the wild, and they're considered endangered. In Canada, however, where there's about 50,000 wolves, the population's in good stead, really.
You'll be going up to see this pack of wolves again next summer. Do you want to make more progress than you've already made in getting them acclimated to you and in getting close to them?
No, I don't need to make any more progress. They are so acclimated to me that even in the summer of 1987, one of the little pups that was only about 4 or 5 weeks old waddled up to me and untied my bootlace while the mother watched, and the mother was only a few feet away from me at the time. So they're acclimated well enough for me to do all of that. I really only need to continue that degree of acclimation, and I can do all of the studies that I want to.
What's the next study you want to do?
Well, I need to continue watching. It's not really a separate study. We do several things, several studies all at the same time, really. But one of the objectives is to try to learn why some individuals, some offspring of the parents, remain with the pack while others leave at the age of about a year or so, a year and a half or a year, and just why the ones that stay with the pack for longer are allowed to stay there, and what their role is in the pack in association with the newborn pups and with the adults.
Has it gotten to the point where it's sometimes a relief to get away from people and to spend time alone in the high Arctic with wolves?
It's always been a relief to get away from people. That's just, I think a lot of people find that. That's why people go canoeing in the wilderness, why they go camping and vacationing, and at least a certain segment of the population finds that. And it's always, all my life, it's been a relief to get away from people, and this just allows me to get farther away than usual.
It sure does. Thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Dr. David Meech. His new book, The Arctic Wolf, is published by Voyager Press. Meech is a wildlife research biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with political economist Benjamin Harrison. His new book, The Great U-Turn, makes the case that the massive corporate restructuring of the 1980s has led to a lower standard of living for most Americans and a greater gap between the incomes of the middle class and the wealthy. Harrison and his co-author Barry Bluestone make some suggestions for how to turn the economy around. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Animator Sally Cruikshank did the credits for the film Ruthless People and the cartoon Hell sequence in Twilight Zone the movie. Her own cartoons are inspired by the classic cartoons of the 1930s. Coming up, Sally Cruikshank explains her colorful, hyperkinetic world where every animal can sing and dance. Also today, our rock historian Ed Ward has a profile of the Kaleidoscope, a band that 20 years before world music was mixing the sounds of Africa, the Caribbean, and even psychedelia. And book critic John Leonard reviews the latest collection of essays by the Irish writer and world traveler Conor Cruise O'Brien. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green in Washington. So far, the political experts are wrong. Voter turnout across most of the country is reported to be heavy, much heavier than usual. Analysts had predicted a poor turnout. George Bush today made no predictions as he voted in his adopted hometown of Houston. Michael Dukakis ended his drive for the White House with early election morning appearances in Iowa and Michigan before flying home to Brookline, Massachusetts. Democrats expect to maintain or better their majorities in the House and Senate. In the Senate, Republicans hope to score gains in the Florida and Montana Senate races, but incumbent Republicans are threatened in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Nebraska, and Nevada. In the House, all 335 seats, that's 435 seats, are up for grabs. Most of the tightest races are among the 27 open seats. The Democrats currently enjoy a 56-46 edge in the Senate and a 255-177 majority in the House. It sounded like a valedictory. A speech at the State Department by George Shultz, whose six-year run as Secretary of State is nearing an end. Shultz's message was that nuclear weapons make this a difficult world and countries have to find ways to cooperate. And he offered some advice for the nation's next president. Details from Barry Schwide.
Shultz said whoever wins shouldn't be afraid to work with the Soviet Union as Mikhail Gorbachev pursues his reforms, provided it is in the U.S. interest. Shultz said Gorbachev is working to make the Soviet Union a different place and that he deserves credit for trying to improve the prospects for democracy and for peace. Later, Shultz spoke at an exhibit of a Soviet photographer, Sergei Petrov, who has been trying unsuccessfully to get a visa for 7 years. Criticizing immigration restrictions, Shultz said the U.S. will continue to press hard for Petrov's release. In his speech, though, Shultz dealt warmly with the Gorbachev era, stressing that it is a growing basis for the U.S. and the Soviets to work together for peaceful purposes. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
China's Civil Affairs Ministry today announced that more than 930 people are known dead in the earthquake that hit a remote border area Sunday night. Official Beijing radio says army rescue and medical teams have reached the devastated region near the Burmese border. The report said more than 100 people have been rescued from the rubble of collapsed buildings. Many other victims are believed to still be trapped. Sunday's earthquake registered 7.6 on the Richter scale, the most powerful to hit China in more than a decade. Shipyard workers in Gdansk, Poland, today defied Solidarity leader Lech Wałęsa and walked off their jobs. Wałęsa backed away from a decision to call for a nationwide strike alert and instead appealed to workers for moderation. Jane Dobia reports from Warsaw.
The union leader told a crowd of 6,000 at a rally inside the Lenin shipyard that he didn't want to go on strike. Instead of deepening the country's crisis, he said he wanted to resolve problems that stand in the way of negotiations between the government and the opposition. Nevertheless, workers at two shipyards in Gdańsk, the Repair and Wisła, walked off their jobs. They're demanding the government begin talks immediately with the opposition and reverse a decision to close the Lenin shipyard where Solidarity was born. Wałęsa has warned that the strikes are a sign he may be losing control over young radical workers who feel the union leader has won no concessions from the government. Tonight will be a decisive test of his influence, proving whether workers who remain inside both the Wisła and repair shipyards will heed Wałęsa's call. For National Public Radio, I'm Jane Dobia in Warsaw.
Stock prices were slightly higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 2 points to close at 2127.49. Advances led decline 7-5 on volume of 142 million shares. Average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 11 cents. I'm Sharon Green in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Every once in a while, a rock band emerges with a sound that foreshadows the future. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says that was the case with the group Kaleidoscope in the late 60s. Here's a sample of their global sound, a tune called Egyptian Garden.
Spent all of my money, honey, to spend the rest of the night and to watch her do that thing that they call Gashi Mirai.
Ask any trendy tastemaker these days what's hip. Well, for one, there's world music, African, Caribbean, and Near Eastern, like Ofer Haas's records. For another thing, American roots music is doing very well. There are even some of the old-time L.A. guys combining these influences nicely, people like David Lindley. Well, let me take you back 22 years then, when all of these things were present in one goofy band, the Kaleidoscope. This was the band the New Yorker called Impressive, although Teen Set magazine needed to add that the band had never been hastily ushered from hysterical mobs. So true, so true. All they were five or six guys with much too much education, a broad interest in various string instruments, and the same sort of sense that most people had in 1966 that anything was possible. Even a recording contract. Despite the fact that the Kaleidoscope wasn't as visible as the Birds or the Doors in Los Angeles, Epic, a division of CBS, signed them up right off the bat. Their first album, Side Trips, was in the running for the ugliest cover of the year, but inside it was something else.
I feel the darkness of our pulsating dream, being held by those whose minds are unclean. You love your power, but you're blind.
There was state-of-the-art LA folk rock, expertly played. There were American folk classics, slightly updated, that reflected the time some of the band had spent in commercial folk groups.
Well, if the river was whiskey and I was a duck, fly to the bottom and I'd never come up. Oh, baby, how long have I got to wait? Why can't I get you now?
And then there was one moment when the Near Eastern influence, the psychedelic influence, and the folk influence converged to make a forgotten masterpiece, their version of Doc Boggs' Appalachian Gothic number, Oh Death.
My name is Death and none can excel. I can open the gates to heaven or hell. I can cast aside the flesh of thee, cast it aside and set you free.
This combination of Arabic string instruments, Appalachian folk materials, 12-string guitar, and Turkish percussion was due to the mixing of David Lindley, who had worked with the likes of the New Christy Minstrels, Chris Darrow, a graphic artist who dabbled in folk music, and David Solomon Felthaus, who was born and raised in Turkey and had played with such noted Turkish pop musicians as Emin Gunduz. The wild card was a man whose name is still not certain, a psychedelic wanderer who called himself Fenris Epp, Templeton Parsley, and Max Buda, among other things, and was expert on playing standard rock instruments in non-standard ways. In late 1968, Kaleidoscope released their second album, called A Beacon from Mars, and it might as well have been for all the sense it made to most record buyers.
Don't love me, yes I do.
Despite inventing Canned Heat's entire sound in their version of You Don't Love Me, both the title tune, a 13-minute psychedelic boogie extravaganza, and Taksim, a glorious fusion of Indian and Turkish influences, were beyond radio and most rock fans. Chris Darrow and the drummers split, leaving the mysterious guy, Lindley, and Felthouse in charge of things, which wasn't all bad. On songs like Lie to Me, the influences were fused tighter than ever before, and for Psychedelic Voyagers, there was a long jam on the second side of the third album. But it was getting apparent that Kaleidoscope was being held together by their contract and little else. As the 70s dawned, Lindley began playing with Jackson Browne, a local songwriter, and Chris Darrow made a few solo albums. The rest of them disappeared, and it probably doesn't make them feel any better to know they were 20 years ahead of their time.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. Animator Sally Cruikshank created ruthless credits for the film Ruthless People. Each actor's name which appeared on the screen came to a violent end. One was run over by a truck, one electrocuted in a pool, and another sucked into a tornado. Sally Cruikshank spends most of her time making her own short cartoons, starring her regular cast of oddball animals. Among that cast are Anita, a female duck who looks like Mae West but talks with a New Jersey accent, Quasi, her short, twerpy sidekick, and Snazzy, a lounge lizard. Her latest cartoon, Face Like a Frog, is featured in an animation festival called Streams of Consciousness. The festival is ending its first run at the Film Forum in New York and will tour nationally in a few months. The music for Face Like a Frog was written by Danny Elfman, who scored both Pee Wee Herman movies. Face Like a Frog takes place in a haunted house where a suave singing lizard issues the warning, "Don't go in the basement."
Oh! You can tell a dirty story in the old conservatory, but don't go in the basement. You can make a scene of the mezzanine, but don't go in the basement. On the old front porch, but don't go in the basement. Or you may think that it's real cool to ride down the banister like some darn fool. Oh, don't go in the basement.
Your song Don't Go in the Basement from Face Like a Frog, the song reminded me of how Max Fleischer used to use Cab Calloway and Louis Armstrong records in his cartoons.
When I first saw the Betty Boop cartoons, I was just so overwhelmed. I couldn't believe what a euphoric, crazy feeling they had. And that's definitely exactly what I'm trying to attain in my movies.
One more connection I'd like to make between your cartoons and some of the classic early cartoons is the sense of surrealism. In one of your cartoons, you know the expression she looked at him with daggers in her eyes. So in one of your cartoons, when she gets angry, daggers literally come out of her eyes and aim at the guy she's angry at.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I liked being able to surprise people, just suddenly showing things that you would never expect to see. Open a door and anything can be behind it. whatever you think would be funny or surprising.
Although your cartoons seem to have so much in common with early cartoons, your drawing style, your painting style, seems very, very contemporary to me. The really saturated colors that you use, the constant movement. Things move at a much quicker pace, I think, in your cartoons than than they used to. Wild, clashing patterns. They're very busy, your cartoons.
Mm-hmm. I do like things that are detailed, and I like to keep it moving. I don't like any dull moment in a cartoon. To me, they don't move too fast, but I've had other people look at them and say, whoa, slow it down. They can't make sense of it going by so quickly. But the colors is partly an attribute of the paints that are available now. I love the bright colors, and to me, the really intense colors just add to the heightened mood, sort of the heightened crazy giddy feeling, and I like to explore that as much as I can.
Funding must be very hard for an animated feature or for a cartoon, because it's very labor intensive, it's very expensive to make, and it ends up being very short. Face Like a Frog, your latest feature, which is in the animation festival, that's 5 minutes long. How much money did it take to make it, and how much time?
It took about 3 years to make it. It took about $14,000, and it is just an overwhelmingly oppressive process that you get the idea, and you have all these crazy ideas, and you draw them up in 2 weeks, and then several years later, you're still trying to realize them through the complicated process of animation.
I guess you have to find an idea that you feel you're going to like for several years to come. Otherwise, you're stuck animating an idea that you thought you liked, but you grew tired with.
Well, that's really a problem, because you're always going to grow tired of them. And when you finally finish it, you wonder what was ever going through your mind in the first place to make you write such a crazy story. But because the time just separates you from the original inspiration. But that's one of the unfortunate aspects, especially in independent animation. In the past, they could turn the cartoons out in about 2 months or 6 weeks. So you could have an idea, put it through the studio process, and there it would be on the screen, and then you'd start with another one. Whereas now, with a couple of years for every single idea or single storyline you've got, it attaches more importance to it than you may want to consider as you start one. In fact, you can't consider it or you'll never get started.
And it takes so long because you're working alone and not in a large group of animators for a studio?
Yeah, I'm doing most of the work myself, although all the coloring in work is done by other people, but I even hand ink them myself because I like a particular look of the line with hand inking, and it's hard to get it. Most people don't do that anymore.
Your cartoon, Quasi's Cabaret, is really a coming attraction for a longer feature that you'd like to do. The cartoon is a coming attraction to sell possible backers on the idea of investing in the longer version.
Quasi's Cabaret, an animated musical comedy extravaganza starring Quasi, Anita, and Snazzy.
I love the nightlife.
Together in Quasi's Cabaret. Suave, sophisticated, shocking. So exciting it'll make you dizzy. Spills, thrills, and mystery. High-flying fun. It's Quasi's Cabaret.
How did you come up with this very novel idea to get backers?
Well, I was so frustrated with the slow production process on the shorts, and I was getting so much response to them. They were playing a lot as theatrical shorts, and I thought it was time to get a feature going, because actually a feature takes about the same length of time, although you just hire a whole lot of people and end up with a movie that's 80 minutes long instead of 8 minutes long. So I thought if I made a trailer as if the feature already existed, selling the attractions of this film, that might be the way to go to convince somebody to actually back the movie. Unfortunately, it didn't seem to work, but it was fun making the little short.
You didn't get any bites on it?
People were interested, but animation scares off most people with money. It's amazing that Roger Rabbit got made. They don't understand the process, and so that scares them, and they don't know. They have a hard time believing that adults are really going to enjoy animation, although, in fact, when you travel around doing animation shows, your audience is, I'd say, 90% adults and 10% kids that are dragged along.
You did the animation for one of the stories in Twilight Zone, the movie. It was the story directed by Joe Dante. The story is about a kid who could make any wish come true. And to punish a friend of his, he wishes her into cartoon land. Describe the kind of hell, the cartoon hell that you created for her.
The cartoon hell I put the girl in was was quite nightmarish. That was the first time I really got to experiment with what I then went on to do in Face Like a Frog, of that sort of ultra-intense, merry but disturbing kind of animation. With it's almost, it's so giddy, you almost can't bear to look at it.
When did you start making cartoons yourself?
My last year in college, I made my first film, and which was 1971, and I've been doing it ever since.
Did you ever work on or consider working on Saturday morning TV, which is one of the places that cartoonists can find full-time work?
No, I hate Saturday morning television. I really don't see where, how my work could fit into that. This year, actually, somebody hired me to design some characters for a show they were trying to sell, but they thought it was too weird, so that was the end of that.
Where does an animator go? You've been doing your own works, you know, 2 to 5 minute works. You'd like to do a feature, but you're having a lot of trouble getting funding for it. You don't like Saturday morning TV. What are the options for someone in your position?
Well, right now I'm fortunate to be doing some work for Sesame Street. Mm-hmm. I'm doing 3 different little spots for them, three different songs. So it's a lot of fun because I'm actually animating to the music. It's really TV commercials or grants or just, you know, putting together films on your own or teaching. I've never taught, but that's another thing people do to continue to make their films. But there isn't a real market for it, unfortunately. It isn't that there isn't exposure. They are seen on cable TV and there are festivals that come around, but they're not enough to support a person working at animation, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you very much for telling us a little bit about your work.
Oh, thank you.
Animator Sally Cruikshank, this is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
Can you give us a preview of your election coverage?
Well, we'll be hearing from Linda Wertheimer throughout the evening about what's actually happening after the polls close. And we'll be, as the polls close, first in the eastern states and then throughout across the country, we'll report what we know from results and polls in those places. We'll also be hearing an interesting piece from Cokie Roberts, from voters she's spoken to throughout the campaign, asking them the question, do you think there should be a change? Is the country ripe for a change right now, or is it ripe for more of the same? We'll also have, on a slightly different note, Andrei Kudrescu with his advice to the next president.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Terrorism, revolution, and fights for self-determination are now a political reality on most every continent. The Irish author Conor Cruise O'Brien struggles with these issues in a new collection of essays and reviews called Passion and Cunning. But book critic John Leonard says O'Brien sheds little light.
From Conor Cruise O'Brien, we expect expert advice. On his own, and as a troublemaker for the United Nations, he's seen more cataclysm than anybody else who writes as well as he does. Diplomat, historian, literary critic, college professor, newspaper columnist, cross-cultural jack-in-the-box, a kind of Irish André Malraux, he's been everywhere. In his native Ireland, in the Middle East, in Africa and Latin America, he sees a world in ruins. In his shaving mirror, he sees a disappointed child of the Enlightenment, a pessimistic liberal. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold, a blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and O'Brien is depressed. At description, O'Brien is brilliant in these essays and book reviews. At prescription, he's wistful if not slipshod. He never bothers to distinguish between terrorism and revolution, except in Nicaragua. He finds a mix of faith and fatherland, of liberation theology and Marxist social engineering, somehow profoundly original among the Sandinistas, and an awful idea anywhere else. In South Africa, black violence looks more like terror than revolution to him, and worries him just as much as white oppression. His pipe dream proposal is, quote, a multiracial bourgeois coalition with some help from the unions. As if the whites there hadn't already proved they can't coalesce even with themselves except to dig in. Likewise, in the Middle East, it's all terror and no revolution, according to O'Brien. He favors, quote, limited superpower consensus, with some help from the world court, as if the angry and the alienated on the West Bank will listen obediently to pious world opinion. All the agony in Northern Ireland he blames on the IRA, as if Ulster's paramilitary goons and an English army of occupation haven't also played their part in the death of children and of decency. He favors search without warrant and detention without trial. This is certainly pessimistic, but it isn't liberal, nor is it good enough. How could it be, if the best O'Brien can do by way of summing up what terrorism's all about is this, and I quote, "The sentimentalist thinks of the terrorist as driven to violence by grievance or oppression. It would be more realistic to think of the terrorist as hauling himself up by means of the grievance or oppression, and the violence it legitimizes, to relative power, prestige, and privilege in the community to which he belongs. For an unemployed young man in a slum in Sidon, for example, the most promising channel of upward mobility is his neighborhood branch of the National Terrorist Organization." Close quote. Imagine, we're asked to think of terrorism like the army, the church, the trade union movement, organized crime, and professional boxing as an equal opportunity employer for the upwardly mobile and disadvantaged young man from the wrong side of the desert tracks. This leaves out all those violent children from, say, middle-class Germany and Japan, many of them female, too. It ignores everything said on the subject by such brainy writers as Mary McCarthy, Heinrich Böll, Alberto Moravia, Doris Lessing, and Paul Theroux, not to mention Dostoevsky. And it also finesses the original grievance and denies the existing oppression. I'm almost as disappointed by O'Brien as O'Brien is disappointed by the world.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed Conor Cruz O'Brien's new book, Passion and Cunning. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. A talk with Luis Perez on the next Fresh Air. As a teenager, he rebelled against the traditional Mexican music he heard at home. But when he founded the group Los Lobos, he and the other band members found a way to fuse the music of their parents with rock and roll. Their new album returns to traditional Mexican songs. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the music of Hungarian composer Gyorgy Kurtág. His music is not well known in this country, but Lloyd says it rewards repeated listening. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg laments the decline of proverbs and folk wisdom. He says in an age of zingy one-liners, proverbs now sound quaint or cornball. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Salat, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.